Today on Against the Grain, what's inside that seemingly unremarkable object, a metal can of food? How did we get to where we are today, where canned food appears so mundane, when in fact, selling food in a corrodible can to dubious American consumers was an uphill battle for the processed food industry? I'm Sasha Lilly, historian Anna Zeta joins me to look at the role of trade groups, public relations, and political lobbying in the marketing of canned food. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Canned food, by its very nature, is opaque. There it is, hidden in a metal container. Even when we buy it, we're not entirely sure what's inside. We're just required to trust what's on the label. And despite various reasons not to entirely trust canned food, ranging from the tuna mercury scare of the 1970s to concerns about BPA in the lining of cans today, canned food tends to get a pass. And if that seems perplexing, it's probably because it's the result of a great deal of effort on the part of the processed food industry to market canned food. The story of how canned food became palatable and benign is explored in Anna Zeta's book, Canned: The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. Zeta is Assistant Professor of Professional Practice at Oklahoma State University, and she joins me now. Anna, I know you're a historian, but let me start by asking you about canned food in the present. Give us a sense of the processes that go into making a typical can of vegetables or fruit that would be found in an American cupboard.
Well, I will start with a disclaimer that as a historian, I certainly know more about the past than the present. And a lot of my knowledge of the present, I think, is informed by what I see to be the foundations that grew out of the past. So one of the things I try to emphasize in the book, and that very much holds true today with canned food and the larger American food system, is just how complicated the whole system is and how many different sort of parts and players and stops along the line there is. I think with today's farm-to-table movement, there's a much more of an emphasis on reminding people that there's a whole bunch of steps of distribution that happen between production and consumption. But I still think that that's one of the major lessons or messages that I think the people who are interested in kind of alternative food systems need to get across. So I think that paying attention and thinking about what happens to get a can of food to your grocery store shelf can help to show you sort of those behind the scenes things that are so often invisible. So, you know, as with all food, it begins in the ground, it begins in the soil. So today there's many agricultural research stations dedicated to problems of canning agriculture. So crops that are specifically bred for canning that hold up better when they're processed in the high heat and temperature and pressure of canning than the ones that go to your fresh market. So you have lots of people and agricultural scientists working on that. So, and then you have the processing, the harvesting of that crop, the bringing it to a cannery, lots of labor, even with mechanization, many, many people, often unskilled labor, often women labor that is in the factories sorting the peas, if that's, you know, as an example. Helping to ensure quality. There's food safety regulations that all canneries have to comply with. And then there's a really complex system of marketing and warehousing and other sort of storage facilities. As one of the things that distinguishes cans so much is that they are non-perishable for the most part, meaning they can be warehoused, stored until it's time, you know, until the market is ready for sale, and then shipped globally until they end up in your supermarket, and then, you know, getting them into consumer hands and sort of the consumer-facing marketing of it, convincing consumers that they want to buy this brand or this type or this fancy pea or this, you know, grade of tomato. So all of that, I think, gives a snapshot of how complex that system is and how many different people are involved in that very simple, what seems to most consumers, a simple moment of should I buy this can of Campbell's soup or should I not? In fact, there's so much influencing most of our decision making in that space.
And of course, it wasn't always this way. How did Americans tend to eat before the rise of the food canning industry and of course, before other industrial processed foods? And at what point did that change historically?
The invention of canning, the kind of method, which at the time wasn't called canning, but basically the method of taking a food and sealing it in an airtight container and subjecting it to high levels of heat so that the air and is expelled so no bacteria can grow, that was invented around 1800. But it didn't really spread to the United States and take off in any real form until the middle of the 19th century and then definitely after the Civil War. And that's definitely the same period of time that is seeing a change more generally in how Americans are eating and where they're getting their food from, such that at the beginning of the 19th century, it's a pretty local economy, very much. Most of the food that people were eating were coming from either their own farms, gardens, from nearby neighbors just down the street or within their local vicinity, except for, you know, spices and salts and a few delicacy kinds of items. But over the course of the 19th century, as you start to have more shipping technologies emerge with the railroad and Transcontinental Railroad being completed in 1869, with new technologies for shipping food, for processing beef, you know, having centralized slaughter for meat that was then chilled and sold. This is all happening in the later 19th century as well. Canning emerges alongside a lot of those other kind of processing technologies. You also have the emergence of grain processing that's producing flour and then commercially produced bread, which is then taking a lot of that labor out of the home. And so instead of everyone, you know, women waking up in the morning and grinding their own flour or turning that flour into bread, it might just be cheaper or more efficient to go to their local general store and buy that loaf of bread that's been produced and shipped to them. So canning is very much at the early, it's one of the earliest sort of packaged processed foods, if not the earliest one, because it paved the way for the broader processed food industry that we see so predominant in our food system today, the frozen foods and the packaged foods and the cake mixes and the, you know, all of those things. Canning definitely was the first among those. And a lot of the methods that the canners implemented to build a market were then used by those other processed food industries as well.
And when canned foods first emerged, how were they initially received?
For a variety of reasons, it was definitely a slow period of uptake. You know, more than a century, I would say, from invention of canning to actually people seeing it as a product on average that was desirable and that was trustworthy and that they wanted to incorporate. You know, the 1930s is when I argue in the book that canned food started to really be seen as more or less a staple in a lot of homes. So from 1800 to 1930, a long period of time. And that was a lot of reasons. It was both, you know, the very primitive technology of canning, how expensive it was to just even make the individual cans themselves and then to fill them and to process them. All of that made them quite expensive, which meant they were largely used by not ordinary consumers. That is, people who were on the move for various reasons, explorers, soldiers, sailors, expeditions to the north, to the Arctic, people who, you know, didn't have access to agricultural lands in the same way. But it was really only after the Civil War that there was even the sense that both because of technological improvements that made canned food cheaper and also because of the beginning exposure of canned foods to more ordinary consumers, with soldiers being exposed to canned foods in the Union Army and then bringing home that taste and telling their wives or mothers that this might be worth trying, that the canners started to even think of sort of everyday consumers as a potential market. But even then, there was a lot of well-founded prejudice about whether canned food was safe. There were high rates of spoilage, whether that was just, you know, a can that was bloated from having bacteria in it, or a much more silent and deadly killer of botulism that I write about some in the book, that people would actually die from eating bad canned food sometimes, not as often as it was reported to be the case. And beyond that, the food was often not that tasty. You know, it was mushy. It had to be processed for a really long time to be safe. The food inside didn't really taste like fresh food. And so even though it offered this kind of magical ability to eat foods out of season, something that really didn't happen unless you were salting it or putting in a lot of salt or sugar, or drying it, it still wasn't necessarily that appealing. So all of those things, the threat of lack of safety, the fact that it didn't taste that good, the fact that it was unfamiliar, the fact that, as you mentioned, it was in this opaque container, so you just didn't know what you were in for, which made it harder to trust. All of those things made it a pretty uphill battle for canners to build a market.
Who were the canners? And in this case, I'm not asking about the labor, but the owners. To what degree did the companies change over time?
Yeah, so it was very much a dispersed industry for a while. That is to say, almost anyone could be a canner in the sense that if you could set up a fairly inexpensive operation on your farm, you could then take, you know, a kettle that you could then boil cans in and take your own tomatoes from your excess crop that you didn't sell fresh and make a small run of cans that then would be sold to a larger merchandiser. So there were lots of very small operations, very geographically dispersed in a lot of different rural areas, without a great sense of this being some established industry all through the 19th century and the later 19th century. And then beginning in the early 20th century, you start to have some of the bigger canners, some of the canning men who were starting to have bigger market share, more production, start to say that, you know, we should band together, we should come together for mutual benefit. And in the process, they definitely wanted to oust some of the smaller canners who they saw as producing, you know, less productive, less healthy goods, and thus creating a bad name for all canned food. So some influential canners, at first many of them located on the East Coast in Baltimore, was the kind of the beginning of canning, band together, for example, to call for a pure food bill. So the Pure Food and Drug Act that was eventually passed in 1906 was introduced in a different form by canners 20 years earlier. And then when the 1906 Act was actually passed, the canners were among the major proponents of that act. And right after the passage of that act, some of these big, more influential canners banded together to create the National Canners Association, this trade organization that I spent a lot of time with in the book, because they became a pretty influential, well-financed group of men who were operating these, you know, growing industries that were trying to now grow at a larger scale, not just kind of as a side project. So they became the kind of masterminds of the industry that developed.
Well, tell us more about the role of the trade association. How did they operate? What was their goal? How much cohesion were they able to bring among the different theoretically competing members of the canning industry?
That's one of the things I'm trying to draw attention to a little bit in the book, is that these trade organizations then and now are really very powerful. And I think that they can be somewhat invisible to sort of average American consumers. One of the interesting kind of contemporary connections is that today one of the major food trade organizations that exists for the food industry is called the Grocery Manufacturers Association, and it merged with the Food Products Association in 2007 to become just one large organization. And that Food Products Association began as the National Canners Association a century before that. And so today's food industry is very much shaped by the legacy of the National Canners Association. And they have always been a really interesting force of these disparate, sometimes small operators around the country who see a common goal and strength in numbers, the ability to both put their heads together to share research findings. So if one canner worked with a local agricultural experiment station, they would publish their findings in the Canner, which was the name of the trade journal that was released on a regular basis and sent to all members of the Canners Association They had publicity bureau as early as 1909 who worked to put out good press around canned foods, who would actually track down any time in the news it would appear that someone got sick from canned food, which was a newsworthy item then. The publicity bureau would actually go track down that case, go to the doctor where it had been isolated, and try to figure out if there had been some other cause of the sickness, and actually publish a counter narrative to say it wasn't really canned food's fault. And there's one story I mentioned in the book that it turns out that it had actually been a murder that had been covered up as being food poisoning. And they sort of solved a murder in the case in their efforts to redeem canned food's name. They also sponsored things like inspection services to help canners keep a clean operation, and if it passed, they would get a little seal that they could put on their can to say this is a verified, certified can. And later they became much more involved in sort of political organization and political lobbying, organizing money to lobby on behalf of legislation that was in the interest of the food industry, and creating positive associations with legislators in order to influence legal proceedings in their favor. So, and that's certainly a big part of what the Grocery Manufacturers Association does today. So I think it's one of these, we know the name of Coca-Cola or McDonald's or Nabisco, these big brand names, but often they're actually more powerful when they join together under this much less, I think, publicized auspices of the trade organization. And so I wanted to, even though it can feel somewhat wonky or less interesting maybe to talk about trade organizations, I wanted in the book to highlight how those kind of groups can be important players that we should pay attention to as informed consumers.
I'm speaking with Anna Zeta about her book, Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifico Radio. What role has scientific expertise, including universities, played in the canning industry's history in the United States?
It's definitely been a big one. I was actually trained in my doctoral work in the history of science, medicine, and technology. And so I sort of began as someone who's interested in the role that science plays in our contemporary culture. And as I started to write about food, it became clear that the use of scientific research in developing the food that we eat has a very long and storied history, and that's very much true in canned food, in that the canners very early on, even though when, canning, the process that I described earlier, was first invented, there was no notion of germ theory, of the thought that the reason that some food goes bad or that the reason that the canning process can, delay putrefaction was because we were killing off and then keeping out germ growth. But there was, I think there was some insight or kernel of understanding that something was happening in the biological and chemical nature of these cans. And so when germ theory begins to be accepted and emerging in the 1880s in the United States with an awareness that, medical and health issues can be tied to germs, the canners were pretty fast to see a connection and want to embrace the power of science, both bacteriology, but also other realms of scientific expertise to improve their practices. So they were very proactive in seeking solutions to the problems that they saw through science. So they worked, funded, I did my graduate work at the University of Wisconsin, which was one of the major agricultural colleges of agricultural and agricultural experiment stations that was doing all kinds of breeding, plant breeding work, bacteriological work in the late 19th and early 20th century. And so I did a lot of work in the archives there. And the canners were one of the very first to sponsor scientific research in industry's interest, any industry at all, in the early 20th century. And then, of course, the files in industry promotion of Wisconsin research go on to be very big and very full, but the canners were really the first. So they saw the way that, these land-grant colleges like the University of Wisconsin, like Oklahoma State University, where I am now, their mission was to create agricultural science in the public interest, and the canners saw themselves as very much able to benefit from that scientific knowledge. So they worked with agricultural scientists, with bacteriologists, with different forms of technology, and all of these things they saw as critical to building their industry, always with the thought in mind that, you know, working with these scientists will improve the quality of our products, will make consumers more likely to trust our food. So science was definitely a pathway into building a market.
And it sounds like at least some of the scientists are coming from public universities, and so from the public to the private here. To what degree did the growing of crops and the raising of specific crops and not others that might be more friendly to being canned take place in these sorts of institutions, and how did such research affect the food being grown in the U.S.?
I think it was significant. You know, again, from the consumer perspective, it's very easy to sort of see the produce that we see in the market as obvious, or as, you know, we take it for granted that it's there. But I think the reasons that certain crops become popular, there's certain kinds of foods emerge as more profitable for industries, has so much to do with how at the very, the ground level in terms of production, those crops can be most profitably brought under the control of industrial development. Because, you know, without the ways that science can help inform the ability of plants to withstand pests, for example, to not be susceptible to different funguses, which was a real problem with the peas that I write about in Wisconsin canning, it's not profitable. You can't get these things to market. No one wants to buy them because they cost too much. And so the ability of the canners to bring on board the scientific research to solve their problems, to understand how to best harvest. So, you know, if you want to harvest a crop by hand, it's very different than if you're trying to harvest it with a large mechanical harvester in terms of how you want the plants to be uniform. You want all the plants to grow on straight stems. You want everything to be able to be standardized. And if you can't get a plant, if you can't breed a plant to conform to that standardized environment, again, it's not going to succeed in the ultimate marketplace. And so I think that understanding how pivotal that scientific research was, and that it was happening in part because of the funding provided by the canners, that there is that kind of cycle of reinforcement that shapes what we end up actually seeing available to consumers.
Tell us about the role of the state and regulation in the history of canning, which seems to be a complicated story, some of it following food scares like one that you write about to do with canned olives.
Right. Yeah. And regulation is definitely one of the major interesting stories, I think, and maybe the lessons that we can draw in the present, which is that I think we tend to see today as a kind of antagonistic relationship between federal government regulation and industry in general, certainly the food industry. But that was not always the case. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, canners were in the early stages when they were building an industry, when they were vulnerable, when they realized that they needed some kind of external stamp of approval to show to consumers that they were to be trusted, they really sought out government regulation. They invited, they paid for government inspectors in California, which was the major producer of the canned olives that created a botulism outbreak in 1919 and 1920. The canners actually funded a wide-ranging botulism commission with scientists from the leading state universities in Stanford to come in to solve, to figure out what had caused the botulism. And then they paid the State Department of Health to launch a health inspection service that, you know, asking for outside intervention, asking for outside oversight, because they recognized that they had a problem that they needed to solve, and that the sort of optics of that would be positive, that it would convey to consumers that they were being overseen by another outside set of eyes. And that was true, you know, even into the early 1930s. There was a McNary-Mapes amendment to the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1930 that further was brought on by the canners, that further regulated what they could produce and how they would fill their cans. And so all of this was, you know, in some ways opposite of what we see today, in that there was a real desire on the part of the canners to be regulated. But then that starts to shift by the end of the 1930s, during the New Deal, I write about in chapter 4 of my book about how the canners had started to kind of chafe at the increasing regulation that was happening under the New Deal government with the National Recovery Administration, and had also now gained a sense of confidence in their market share and their place in consumer preferences. And so they start to reject that government intervention and start to say, no, we want to sort of do things on our own. And that trend continued from the late 1930s into the present, I would argue, such that now we see this desire on the part of a lot of food industry to not be subjected to more regulation, to instead see it as a real imposition. And I think that that's something that we, as consumers should pay attention to, is that in moments of industry vulnerability, when they see a need to build more consumer confidence, is a moment when there's an opening, I think, to accept more regulation, to think more about how regulation can be profitably used to protect consumers.
So does that mean then that since the 1930s, since the time that the canned food industry and industrial processed food industry more generally sort of pushing back against regulation, the sense that they needed to bring in the state to create consumer confidence had receded, that in especially in the post-war era, that confidence had been, generally speaking, more established, and that therefore this complicated role of the state as overseer was less necessary as kind of good PR?
Yes, that's definitely one of the major arguments of the book, even though the subtitle is The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. Maybe it's been more of a rise and fall and an ebb and sway, but mostly rise. I think that a lot of the kind of concerns today in the food movement are around consumer trust, around this fear from a lot of food producers that consumers no longer really trust the food industry. But the numbers are such that, of course, given the system that we're all a part of, most American consumers still very much purchase, food from produced by the American food industry, because that's kind of all that there is. So yes, I think that the major story is really one of, almost a century and a half of fighting for consumer confidence and then sort of mostly succeeding in that. And then, I do write about, there was definitely the 1960s and 70s brought some pushback from consumer and environmental movements against canned food, against processed food and what it stood for. And although I think that there were some moments that created some positive change, it really only, I think, re-entrenched a lot of the food industry's rejection of government regulation. And I think that's only grown into the present. Although, I think that there are some hopeful trends from a kind of more consumer-directed food movement that has less to do, I think, with government regulation than just sort of bottom-up market pressures.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. That's published by the University of California Press. And I'm speaking with historian Anna Zeta. She is assistant professor of professional practice at Oklahoma State University. We're talking about the history of industrial canned food. And you mentioned that in the 1970s, in the late 60s and 70s, there was the rise of several intersecting movements that put the canned food industry on the back foot. One of those was the environmental movement, and then there was also a consumer movement, people being concerned about health food, in some ways paralleling some of the movements around health in the earlier century, health and food safety all being connected. Tell us about the concerns of that time, particularly as epitomized by the discovery of mercury in canned tuna, which obviously is a staple of the canned food industry.
Yeah, many intersecting sort of forces that are coming into play in the 60s and 70s that start to make canned food feel, canners and the canned food industry feel somewhat on the attack, on the defensive, that they are being attacked. And I think mercury emerges as one a little bit later in this period, where there begins to be findings that tuna, being a sort of larger predatory fish, is bioaccumulating mercury in its flesh so that the tuna that's reaching consumers has really high rates of mercury. And consumers are experiencing mercury poisoning. And this, I think, really fits into this larger awareness of the environmental movement, beginning with Rachel Carson's publication of Silent Spring in 1962, and this awareness of how permeable the boundaries between the environment and the human body and animal bodies really are, and that the production of mercury from factories spewing this into the air is going to end up in our waterways. That then ends up in our fish's bodies, and when we eat that fish's food, it becomes part of the human body. And I think that there was already an existing set of concerns and fears around that permeability for the last decade or so in the 60s, and I think canned food starts to see itself as embedded in that set of fears and needing to manage that concern. And so mercury in canned tuna becomes just one of a range of sort of struggles that the canners are dealing with. And one of the things I write about is how really by the 1970s, at the end of the 1970s, the National Canners Association that I write a lot about changed its name to the National Food Processors Association. And their major journal, which had been called The Canner, becomes Processed Prepared Food. So although we can still talk about canned food in the 70s. A lot of their interests and the power that they bring is now tied up in a much broader processed food industry. And the concerns that are raised about that broader network redound down to canned food as well, so that it's not just an isolated group of just canned food. It becomes something much bigger, which is why I think the book is really about, the American food more generally. And by this point, although the canners recognize a kind of vulnerability and recognize that consumers aren't entirely happy with their product, they also don't quite do what they did in the early 20th century, which is kind of a full-on, accepting responsibility and a need to improve. And it becomes almost more about a public relations campaign and a desire to not necessarily change their practices, but just to change the way that consumers view those practices.
How do you see the role of the American media in this story? Because when there have been scares about food, often there is sometimes sensational reporting about it. And yet the approach of the canned food industry in pushing back often had to do with PR and spin.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interesting in the chapter that looks at the botulism outbreaks in 1919 and 1920. There's very explicit desire on the part of the canners to push back on what they think is, an unfounded level of scrutiny by explicitly, if they had a conference on botulism, they didn't use the word botulism in the title. They would say, spoilage in canned food conference, just because they wanted to keep those words out of the media because they had a sense of what got sensationalized. But I think, one of the major, takeaways or my thoughts on this is that I think that too often food safety scares are treated as kind of one-off instances that, this particular food, alfalfa sprouts this month are unsafe, or romaine lettuce this month. And the concern is just avoid that. And then there's announcement that now it's safe and people move on until there's another one. That rather than seeing those as isolated incidents, which are sort of newsworthy, to do the work that, long-form journalism can do, which is to step back and say, how are all of these incidents not isolated? How are they actually all part of a broader food system that isn't treating food safety as an integrated set of concerns with environmental safety, with the scale of production, with all of these things that are actually causing the problems that we see? So I think that role that the media can play in sort of taking the bigger picture and being able to step back and say what's really at fault can be very powerful and is at various parts in my story, of being able to kind of let consumers acknowledge their own role to play in this broader complex food system that we're all a part of.
Well, with the caveat that you are a historian, as you pointed out earlier, do you have a sense of how the system has gotten safer or less safe since these movements of, let's say, the 1970s drawing attention to food safety, but more broadly, concerns about the health of food and so on. From that time to now, what is your assessment of how safe processed food, canned food in particular, is?
From a perspective of sort of the kinds of things I've been talking a lot about, which is more bacteriological and contamination and these kinds of things, I mean, I think the American food system is remarkably safe and sort of shockingly so, given the scale, size, scope of the number of, you know, products that we have available to us. And so in some ways, I think a lot of the people who are sort of on my side in terms of, I think, critiquing the modern food system sometimes take it too far, I think, in suggesting that there's something dramatically, you know, detrimental about the way that all Americans eat. And I think that's a problem because it also kind of, you know, elides class dynamics and different things that are at play and why people eat what they do. But when it comes to the questions more of health and processed food and what these things are doing in terms of diet-related diseases, and maybe even most importantly, the effects that industrial food production is having on our environment and the way that environmental problems always come down to becoming health problems eventually, I think that's where the real problems lie and where I don't think things are getting better. I don't think that we're improving our attention to those environmental costs and acute health costs of nutrition costs of our food system. And I think canned food in that place becomes less obviously the culprit. I think canned food for what it is not, I don't think, particularly unhealthy and doesn't offer particularly high rates of, you know, saturated fats and other problematic ingredients. Or is any more environmentally unsustainable than most processed foods. But I think that the reason that the canned food industry is important is because I think it pioneered a lot of methods of scaling up, of vertical integration, of political lobbying, of fighting against regulation that other branches of the food industry that carry more unhealthful products have copied and have learned from and have created very similar kinds of models that have more negative effects on the American health and environment. And I think that's where, if there are lessons to be found in history in terms of when could things have been otherwise, when were there turning points that, you know, American consumers or voters or legislators made certain decisions that led us down a bad path, I do think that there's something to be found in this story for thinking about what we need to lobby for in moving forward.
And staying with the present, how do you assess whatever the canned food industry's self-presentation is about the noxious role of the government and the need not to be regulated? How close would you say that the industry is with government entities?
In my last chapter, I write about the problem of BPA or bisphenol A, an endocrine-disrupting chemical that's has historically long been present in the linings of canned foods and is also present in most plastics that we encounter. And I think one of the problems that emerges there that helps us to suss out this connection between industry and government is that a lot of the regulatory structures that are in place to try to help American consumers, such as the FDA, the USDA to some extent as well, that a lot of what has happened to those oversight processes have significantly watered down their ability to actually protect consumers. For example, and I'm not an expert in this particular, you know, aspect of the FDA regulation, but as I understand it, a lot of the criticism is that chemicals that are what are labeled GRAS, generally regarded as safe, don't have to go under extensive testing. And a lot of those categories had been established a long time ago, and a lot of those chemicals have kind of been grandfathered in, so that a lot of things can be called generally regarded as safe, even as if it turns out that new science has uncovered that it can affect us in ways that we didn't know in the past. Or, for example, FDA studies are required, ones that are considered in FDA analyses have to comply with what are called good laboratory practices. And those good laboratory practices, GLP, often are not the same standards that are held, for example, in the academic world for peer review of science. So there's a different set of standards that sometimes can favor industry in those good laboratory practices, so to speak, that are not actually seen by many scientists as being necessary. And actually many academic peer-reviewed journal articles don't meet the criteria of GLP. So I think those are the kind of places, the kind of more complex places of nuanced difference in how effective our regulatory bodies can be in overseeing the industry is because of those weak spots that still can, you know, industry can say we're complying with all the FDA regulations. It's not that we're avoiding them. It's just those regulations don't necessarily always speak in, or aren't always in support of the best interest of the consumer. And I think that's where, you know, the emerging concerns around the kind of revolving door between industry boards and government bodies, you know, that's where those things start to feel very concerning, because how can we improve any of those regulatory practices if the people in charge at the government level are, you know, rotating on and off of industry interests? And that's, I think, where the food industry certainly could work to improve both its public image and the reality of the safety of its products.
Historian Anna Zeta is my guest. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We're talking about her book, Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. One thing I haven't asked you about so far in the hour is the history of labor in the canned food industry, which obviously has changed a lot from the 19th century. But are there generalizations that you can make about the role that labor has played and looking at its trajectory into the 21st century? How has mechanization affected the way that this food is in fact canned?
So I will say it's a weakness of my book. I didn't attend to the questions of labor nearly as much as I did to sort of the industry leaders and consumers. But, you know, as with any food processing, canning has always been a fairly labor-intensive production, also a source of employment in a lot of rural communities because of where, you know, the close situating of canneries near farm and rural communities. But labor concerns have always been present in the canning industry because of how grueling and grinding the work can be and how repetitive it can be and how much it relied on unskilled labor, and lots of concerns around child labor in the early 20th century, as in many other industries during the time. And then today, I think some of the major challenges are the kind of globalization and outsourcing of the canning industry, and something I'm researching now with thoughts on perhaps a later project about kind of the global canning industry and what has happened as even the U.S. has moved a number of its canneries. For example, tuna canneries are, a lot of them are in Guam and in other, you know, not mainland United States. And so you have, again, I think questions about regulation and how those protections that do exist to some to a large extent in the United States do or don't extend to all cannery workers in a broader global context.
There's a lot of concern about the health of Americans that one encounters in the mainstream media about the rise of obesity, diabetes. And one of the questions that keeps coming up is, who is to blame? People are criticized. American consumers are seen to be eating way too much processed food, and health experts point to the need to eat fresh fruits and vegetables. But then the counter response is, well, consumers want processed foods, and we're just giving people what they want. What do you make of that argument that much of the consumption of processed food is driven by consumer needs, consumer wants?
Well, I don't give much credence to that claim. I think that it's disingenuous for any, I think, leadership to claim that that's the case. Because although, yes, I think a lot of human evolutionary drive is to eat fatty and salty and sweet foods. And so, yes, there's a way in which those foods appeal to us, and so consumers don't always make the best decisions. But I also think that there's obvious economic incentives around buying less healthy prepared foods. You know, I think that for anyone who's realistically juggling the many demands that many Americans have around work and family and trying to make ends meet, that when you have, you know, the option of buying fresh fruits and vegetables that cost three times as much for half the calories and, you know, three times the amount of labor it takes to come home and cook those into food versus having cheap packaged and processed and fast foods, there's very little incentive to sort of do the healthy thing. And those cost differentials are not intrinsic to those foods themselves. It's very much the result of agricultural subsidies that make the ingredients in processed foods, the commodity grains and corn that are the foundation of processed foods, those things are cheap or even free for many farmers to grow and sell, whereas there's very, very little, if any, subsidies directed towards fresh fruits and vegetables. And it's this very, unfair thing, I think, that the USDA is both in charge of promoting agricultural production in our country, and also a tiny little piece of it is supposed to help shape nutritional demands, but at the same time that the government is releasing, you know, the My Plate or the latest food pyramid that says half your plate should be devoted to fruits and vegetables, while their subsidies are going to 70% towards, you know, commodity grains and only 3% towards fruits and vegetables. You have to wonder about the disconnect between the rhetoric around what we should be eating and then the actual incentive to help us do that. So, I mean, I think that it's there are some very clear problems that, you know, come from a lack of awareness of many consumers around the Farm Bill, which is the major piece of legislation that usually sets agricultural subsidies. And I think a lot of that happens behind the scenes without a lot of the kind of public attention that gets drawn to other contentious public issues, which means that those decisions happen and we don't even know much about them and or have much of a space to vote for legislators who might speak to our interests. But then, of course, those things are behind the scenes, but the effects are not. You know, the concerns around healthcare, around immigration and migratory labor, all of these things are very much tied to concerns of the food system. It's just that we don't see them as such when they are, when we hear about them on the news.
Well, I want to ask you about the food movement and the way that it tackles many of the questions that you're talking about. One of the things that we hear is a call for transparency. If we could just sort of see what takes place behind the curtain or in the can, so to speak, that people would recognize that the food system is really problematic and would demand a different food system. Do you think that transparency is enough?
No, I don't think it's enough. I do think it's a start. And in fact, that sort of the word transparency was one of the things that I was really interested in when I started this book, because I started working on it a long time ago, because I just thought, you know, what could be more opaque than a can? And how does it embody that broader opacity of our food system? And what is it about transparency, about knowledge, that can help people make better decisions? But I think, as I was suggesting in the previous question, I think, simply knowledge, education is someone who's, you know, who's an educator. Of course, I think education is important, but we all know that simply knowing the right thing to do and actually doing it are not the same thing, that just knowing what is healthy to eat, for example, doesn't mean we're going to eat it or be able to eat it. And so I think that transparency is very much like education. It's this sort of idealistic view that if everyone just knew what went into things, they would, you know, change their behavior. But I think that ignores all of the many economic, cultural, family, historical associations behind why people eat what they eat. And it's very hard to make changes. And I think sometimes demanding that people make changes can be, you know, pretty insensitive to a lot of the other circumstances that shape people's decision-making around food. So I don't think that transparency is enough. I think it's a start, and I think it's an important piece of the puzzle. But I also think we need to then make acting on that transparency easier and more realistic for Americans in the complex web of demands that people have on their lives.
What kind of political pressure do you think people can exert on the system? I mean, especially if, as you're saying, we might want to be wary of what often can have a somewhat elitist whiff to it of a food movement that says, well, everyone should just eat healthily without looking at all the constraints and other circumstances in people's lives beyond what they're deciding to buy at the store. So what way do you think makes most sense at coming at these questions, whether you want to answer direct in a more narrow way around particularly the canned food movement and its political power, or more broadly?
Two places that I see as potential and hopeful spaces for change. One is with that revision of the Farm Bill that I was mentioning, especially around agricultural subsidies. And I don't know that this is, you know, I don't know how realistic it is, although there are many different groups working on this realm. But I think if we could see a need to subsidize the production of healthier crops such that our fruits and vegetables in the grocery store would be cheaper, I think that is a very important start, because I do think there are people who go in there with the thought, I'm going to buy vegetables for my kids' dinner tonight, and then they see the cost and they just can't justify it. So I think an awareness of how our tax dollars are being used to incentivize certain kinds of production. But I also think that a lot of these changes that I mentioned in terms of kind of cultural and historical connections to food does start when people are children. And so I do think that there's a lot of power in our public schools and in their attention to food as a critical part of a broader education system. In Wisconsin, I helped to work on the Wisconsin School Garden Initiative that helped to launch school gardens in many of the schools of the state. And I saw that having a really big impact in just a couple years' time, just kids having exposure to different kinds of foods that made them want to try other foods and to see fresh fruits and vegetables grown in dirt that they helped to grow in as potential food. They would, you know, come home and tell their parents, and then that would sometimes yield changes. And I think that, you know, rather than telling people to change their behavior and their ways at a point at which I do think it's kind of culturally insensitive to do so, starting with kids when they still have the space to learn and to see food as an integrated part of their knowledge and their health system, and to bring public schools into that, I think is very helpful. And there are a lot of movements and nonprofits and school systems working on doing that kind of change at the young age. And I think it's an important and promising place to start.
We'll have to leave it right there. Anna Zeta, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I've been speaking with the author of Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. That's published by the University of California Press. And you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Historian Anna Zeta is Assistant Professor of Professional Practice at Oklahoma State University. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.